they passed two settlements, nothing more than a church house and a few little stores, but settlements anyway, and not 10 miles apart.
"Now look at that," Augustus said. "The darn people are making towns everywhere, and it's our fault, you know."
"It ain't our fault, and it ain't our business either," Carl said. "People can do what they want."
"Why, naturally, since we chased out the Indians and hung all the good bandits," Augustus said. "Does it ever occur to you that everything we done was probably a mistake? Just look at it from a nature standpoint. If you got enough snakes around the place, you won't be overrun with rats nor varmints. The way I see it, the Indians and the bandits have the same job to do. Leave 'em be, and you won't constantly be having to ride around these darn settlements."
"You don't have to ride around 'em," Carl said. "What harm do they do?"
"If I'd have wanted civilization, I'd have stayed in Tennessee and wrote poetry for a living," Augustus said. "Me and you done our work too well. We killed off most of the people that made this country interesting to begin with."
Carl didn't answer. It was one of Gus's favorite themes, and if given a chance, he would expound on it for hours. Of course, it was nonsense. Nobody in their right mind would want the Indians back, or the bandits either. Whether Gus had ever been in his right mind was an open question.
"Carl, you ought to have married and had 6 or 8 kids, Augustus remarked.
If he couldn't get anywhere with one subject, he liked to move on to another. Carl's spirits hadn't improved much. When he was low, it was hard to get him to talk.
"I can't imagine why you think so," Carl said. "Wonder what's become of Jake." "Why, Jake's moseying along, starved for a card game, probably," Augustus said.
"He ought to leave that girl and throw in with us," Carl said.
"You ain't listening," Augustus said. "I was trying to explain why you ought to marry. If you had a passel of kids, then you'd always have a troop to boss when you felt like bossing. It would occupy your brain, and you wouldn't get gloomy as often."
"I doubt that marriage could be worse than having to listen to you," Carl said. "But that ain't much of a testimonial for it." They reached San Antonio late in the day, passing near one of the old missions. A Mexican boy in a brown shirt was bringing in a small herd of goats.
"Maybe we ought to take a few goats to Montana," Augustus said. "Goats can be melodious, more so than your cattle. They could accompany the Irishman, and we'd have more of a sing-song."
"I'll settle for more of a wagon," Carl said. Fortunately, they were able to buy one almost at once from a big livery stable north of the river. It was necessary to buy 2 more mules to pull the wagon back to the herd. Fortunately, the mules were cheap, $20 a head, and the big German who ran the livery stable threw in the harness. Augustus volunteered to drive the wagon back to the herd on condition he could have a drink and a meal first. He hadn't been to San Antonio in years, and he marveled at the new establishments that had sprung up.
"Well, this place'll catch New Orleans if it don't stop growing," he said. "If we'd put in a barber shop 10 years ago, we'd be rich now."
There was a big saloon on the main street that they'd frequented a lot in their rangering days. It was called the Buckhorn because of the owner's penchant for using deer horns for coat and hat racks. His name was Willie Montgomery, and he had been a big crony of Augustus's at one time. Carl suspected him of being a card sharp, but if so, he was a careful card sharp.
"I guess Willie'll be so glad to see us, he'll offer us a free dinner at least," Augustus said as they trotted over to the saloon. "Maybe a free whore, too, if he's prospering."
But when they strode in, there was no sign of Willie or anyone they recognized. A young bartender with slick hair and a string tie gave them a look when they stepped to the bar, but seemed as if he could scarcely be troubled to serve them. He was wiping out glasses with a little white towel and setting each one carefully on a shelf. The saloon was mostly empty, just a few card players at a table in the back. Augustus was not one to stand patiently and be ignored by a bartender.
"I'd like a shot of whiskey, and so would my companion, if it ain't too much trouble," he said.
The bartender didn't look around until he had finished polishing the glass he had in his hand. "I guess it ain't, old-timer," he said. "Rye, or what will it be?"
"Rye will do, provided it gets here quick," Augustus said,
straining to be polite. The young bartender didn't alter his pace, but he did provide two glasses and walked slowly back to get a bottle of whiskey. "You darned cowboys ought to broom yourselves off before you walk in here," he said with an insolent look. "We can get all the sand we need without the customers bringing it to us. That'll be $2. Augustus pitched a $10 gold piece on the bar, and as the young man took it, suddenly reached out and grabbed his head and smashed his face into the bar before the young man could even react. Then he quickly drew his big Colt, and when the bartender raised his head, his broken nose gushing blood onto his white shirt front, he found himself looking right into the barrel of a very big gun.
"Besides the liquor, I think we'll require a little respect," he said. "I am Captain McCrae, and this is Captain Call. If you care to turn around, you can see our pictures when we was younger. Among the things we don't put up with is dawdling service. I'm surprised Willie would hire a surly young idler like you."
The card players were watching the proceedings with interest, but the young bartender was too surprised at having suddenly had his nose broken to say anything at all. He held his towel to his nose, which was still pouring blood. Augustus calmly walked around the bar and got the picture he had referred to, which was propped up by the mirror with three or four others of the same vintage. He laid the picture on the bar, took the glass the young bartender had just polished, slinging it lazily into the air in the general direction of the card players, and then the roar of the big Colt filled the saloon. Call glanced around in time to see the glass shatter. Augustus had always been a wonderful pistol shot. It was pleasing to see he still was. All the card players scurried for cover except a fat man in a big hat. Looking more closely, Call remembered him. His name was Ned Tim, and he was a seasoned gambler, too seasoned to be disturbed by a little flying glass. When it stopped flying, Ned Tim coolly took his hat off and blew the glass off the brim. "Well, the Texas Rangers is back in town," he said. "Hello, Gus. Next time I see a circus, I'll ask them if they need a trick shot."
"Why, Ned, is that you?" Augustus said. "My old eyes are failing. If I'd recognized you, I'd have shot your hat off and saved the glass. Where do you keep your extra aces these days?"
Before Ned Tim could answer, a man in a black coat came running down the stairs at the back of the saloon. He wasn't much older than the bartender. "What's going on here, Ned?" the man asked, prudently stopping by the card table. Augustus still held a big pistol in his hand.
"Oh, nothing, John," Ned said. "Captain McCrae and Captain Call happened in, and Captain McCrae gave us a little demonstration with his pistol, that's all." "It ain't all," a bartender said in a loud voice. "The old son of a bitch broke my nose."
With a movement so graceful it seemed almost gentle, Augustus reached across the bar and rapped the bartender above the ear with his gun barrel. A tap was enough. The bartender slid out of sight and was seen no more.
"Why'd you do that?" the man in the black coat asked.
He was angry, but even more, he seemed surprised. Call glanced at him and judged him no threat. He sipped his whiskey and left the theatrics to Augustus.
"I'm surprised you'd have to ask why I did that," Augustus said, holstering his gun. "You heard the name he called me. If that's city ways, they don't appeal to me. Besides, he was a dawdling bartender and deserved a lick. Do you own this place, or what's your gripe?"
"I own it," the man said. "I don't allow shooting in it, either."
"What became of Wee Willie Montgomery?" Augustus asked. "You didn't have to whack a bartender just to get a glass of whiskey when he owned it." "Willie's woman run off," Ned Tim informed them. "He decided to chase her, so he sold the place to Johnny here." "Well, I can't say that I think he made a good choice," Augustus said, turning back to the bar. "Probably chose bad in the woman department, too. Maybe if he's lucky, she'll get plumb away." "Now they're living up in Fort Worth," Ned said. Willie was determined not to lose her. Call was looking at the picture Augustus had fetched from behind the bar. It was one of himself, Gus, and Jake Spoon, taken years before. Jake was grinning and had a pearl-handled pistol stuck in his belt, whereas he and Gus looked solemn. It had been taken in the year they chased Kicking Wolf and his band all the way to the Canadian, killing over 20 of them. Kicking Wolf had raided down the Brazos, messing up several families of settlers and scaring people in the little settlements. Driving them back to the Canadian had made the Rangers heroes for a time, though Call had known it was hollow praise. Kicking Wolf hadn't been taken or killed, and there was nothing to keep him on the Canadian for long. But for a few weeks, everywhere they went, there was some photographer with his box wanting to take their picture. One had cornered them in the buckhorn and made them stand stiffly while he got his shot. The young man in the black coat went over behind the bar and looked at the fallen bartender. "Why'd you have to break his nose?" he asked.
"He'll thank me someday," Augustus said. "It will make him more appealing to the ladies. He looked too much like a long-tailed rat as it was. With no better manners than he had, I expect he was in for a lonely life."
"Well, I won't have this," the young man said loudly. "I don't know why you old cowboys think you can just walk in and do what you please. What's that picture doing on the bar?"
"Why, it's just a picture of us boys, back in the days when they wanted to make us senators," Augustus said. "Willie kept it on the mirror there, so when we happened in, we could see how handsome we used to look."
"I'm a notion to call the sheriff and have the two of you arrested," the young man said. "Shooting in my bar is a crime, and I don't care what you done 20 years ago. You can get out of here and be quick about it, or you'll end up spending your night in jail." He got angrier as he spoke. "Oh, now, John, I wouldn't threaten these gentlemen if I was you," Ned Tim said, appalled at what he was hearing. "This is Captain Call and Captain McCrae." "Well, what's that to me?" the man said, whirling on Ned. "I've never heard of them, and I won't have these old cowboys coming in here making this kind of mess."
"They ain't old cowboys," Ned said. "They're Texas Rangers. You've heard of them, you just forgot."
"I don't know why I would have," the man said. "I just lived here 2 years, miserable ones at that. I don't necessarily keep up with every old-timer who ever shot an Indian. It's mostly tall tales anyway, just old men bragging on themselves."
"John, you don't know what you're talking about," Ned said, growing more alarmed. "Captain Call and Captain McCrae would be the last ones to brag."
"Well, that's your opinion," John said. "They look like braggarts to me."
Call was beginning to feel annoyed, for the young man was giving them unmannerly looks and talking to them as if they were trash. But then it was partly Gus's fault. The fact that the bartender had been a little slow and insolent hadn't necessarily been a reason to break his nose. Gus was touchy about such things, though. He enjoyed having been a famous Texas Ranger and was often put out if he didn't receive all the praise he thought he had coming. Gus held the picture out so the young man could see it.
"You have to admit that's us," he said. "Why would you keep our picture propped up behind your bar and then expect us to stand here and be treated like spit when we walk in?"
"Oh, well, I never even noticed those darn pictures," John said. "I ought to have thrown all that junk out, but I never got around to it. Just drink your drink and ski-daddle or be ready to go to jail. Here comes the sheriff now."
Sure enough, in about a minute, Toby Walker stepped into the bar. He was a heavy-set man with a walrus mustache who looked older than his years. Carl was amused to see him, for what the angry young man didn't know was that Toby had been in their ranger troop for 4 years just before they quit. He had only been 16 then, but he made a good ranger. Toby had looked up to both of them as if they were gods, and was an unlikely man to arrest them. His eyes widened when he saw them. "Why, can it be?" he asked. "Captain Call?" "Well, Toby," Call said, shaking his head. Augustus, too, was highly amused by the turn of events.
"I got, Toby," he said. "I guess it's your duty to handcuff us and march us off to jail."
"Why would I do that?" Toby asked. "There's times when I think I ought to jail myself, but I don't know why I'd want to jail you two."
"Because you're hired to keep the peace, and these old soaks have been disturbing it," John said.
The fact that Toby obviously recognized them only made him more testy. Toby became immediately frosty.
"What's that you say, John?" he asked.
"I guess you heard me, Sheriff, unless you're deaf," John said. "These men came in here and broke my bartender's nose. Then one of them shot off a gun for no reason. Then they pistol-whipped the bartender. I offered them a chance to leave, but since they haven't, I'm a notion to file charges and let the law take its course."
He said his little say so pompously that it struck the three of them as funny. Augustus laughed out loud. Carl and Toby smiled. Even Ned Tim chimed in with a chuckle.
"Son, you've misjudged our reputation," Augustus said. "We was the law around here when you was still sucking on a tit. So many people think we saved them from the Indians that if you was to bring charges against us, and any of the boys that rangered with us got wind of it, they'd probably hang you. Anyway, whacking a surly bartender ain't much of a crime."
"John, I'd advise you to stop your name-calling," Toby said. "You're acting too hot. You'd best just apologize and bring me a whiskey."
"I'll be damned if I'll do either one," John said, and without another word stepped over the fallen bartender and went back upstairs. "What's he got, a whore up there?" Augustus asked, hopefully.
He was beginning to feel restive and would have liked some female company.
"Yes, John keeps a señorita," Toby said. "I guess you'll have to excuse him. He's from Mobile, and I've heard it said people in those parts are hot-headed."
"Well, it ain't a local prerogative," Augustus said. "We got hot-heads in our crew. And ain't none of them from Mobile, Alabama."
They got a whiskey bottle and sat down at a table and chatted for a while, talking of old times. Toby inquired after Jake, and they carefully refrained from mentioning that he was on the run from the law. While they were talking, the bartender got up and staggered out the back way. His nose had stopped bleeding, but his shirt was drenched with blood.
"Hell, he looks like he's been butchered," Toby said cheerfully.
Ned, Tim, and his friend soon resumed their card game, but the other players' nerves were shaken, and Ned soon drained them of money. Toby Walker looked wistful when they told him they were taking a herd to Montana. "If I hadn't married, I bet I'd go with you," he said. "I imagine there's some fair pastures up there. Being a lawman these days is mostly a matter of collaring drunks, and it does get tiresome." When they left, he went off dutifully to make his rounds. Augustus hitched the new mules to the new wagon. The streets of San Antonio were silent and empty as they left. The moon was high, and a couple of stray goats nosed around the walls of the old Alamo, hoping to find a blade of grass. When they had first come to Texas in the 40s, people had talked of nothing but Travis and his gallant losing battle. But the battle had mostly been forgotten and the building neglected.
"Well, Carl, I guess they forgot us. Like they forgot the Alamo," Augustus said.
"Why wouldn't they?" Carl asked. "We ain't been around."
"Well, that ain't the reason. The reason is we didn't die, Augusta said. Now, Travis lost his fight, and he'll get in the history books when someone writes up this place. If 1,000 Comanches had cornered us in some gully and wiped us out, like the Sioux just done Custer, they'd write songs about us for 100 years.
It struck Call as a foolish remark. I doubt there was ever 1,000 Comanches in one bunch, he said. If there had been, they would have taken Washington, D.C. But the more Augustus thought about the insults they had been offered in the bar, a bar where once they had been hailed as heroes, the more it bothered him.
I ought to have given that young pup from Mobile a rap or two, he said.
He was just scared, Carl said. I'm sure Toby will lecture him next time he sees him.
It ain't the point, Woodrow, Augusta said. You never do get the point.
Well, what is it, darn it, Carl asked.
We'll be the Indians if we last another 20 years, Augusta said. The way this place is settling up, it'll be nothing but churches and dry goods stores before you know it. Next thing you know, they'll have to round up us old rowdies and stick us on a reservation to keep us from scaring the ladies.
I'd say that's unlikely, Carl said.
It's darn likely, Augusta said. If I can find a squaw I like, I'm apt to marry her. The thing is, if I'm going to be treated like an Indian, I might as well act like one. I think we spent our best years fighting on the wrong side.
Call didn't want to argue with nonsense like that. They were nearly to the edge of town, passing a few adobe hovels where the poorer Mexicans lived. In one of them, a baby cried. Call was relieved to be leaving. With Gus on the prod, anything could happen. In the country, if he had got mad and shot something, it would probably be a snake, not a rude bartender. We didn't fight on the wrong side, Call said. What's a miracle is that you stayed on the right side of the law for as long as you have. Jake's too cowardly to be much of an outlaw, but you ain't.
Thou may be one yet, Augusta said. You'd be better than ending up like Toby Walker, roping drunks for a living. Why, the man nearly cried when we left. He wanted to come so bad. Toby used to be quick. Look at him now, as fat as a gopher.
It's true, he's put on weight, but then Toby was always chunky built, Call said. On that one, though, he suspected Gus was right. Toby had looked at them sadly when they mounted to ride away.
Chapter 43.
As far as Roscoe was concerned, travel started bad and got worse. For one thing, it seemed he would never find Texas, a fact that preyed on his mind. From all indications, it was a large place, and if he missed it, he would be laughed out of Fort Smith, assuming he ever got back. When he started out, he supposed that the easiest way to find Texas would be just to ask the settlers he encountered. But most of the settlers proved to be a remarkably ignorant lot. Most of them seemed never to have been more than a few hundred feet from the place they happened to be settled. Many were unable to give directions to the next settlement, much less to a place as remote as Texas. Some were able to point in the general direction of Texas, but after riding a few miles, dodging thickets and looking for suitable crossings in the many creeks, Roscoe could not be sure he was still proceeding in that direction. Fortunately, the problem of direction was finally solved one afternoon when he ran into a little party of soldiers with a mule team. They claimed to be heading for some place called Buffalo Springs, which was in Texas. There were only 4 soldiers, 2 horseback and 2 in the wagon, and they had relieved the tedium of travel by getting drunk. They were generous men, so generous that Roscoe was soon drunk, too. His relief at finding men who knew where Texas was caused him to imbibe freely. He was soon sick to his stomach. The soldiers considerately let him ride in the wagon, not much easier on his stomach, for the wagon had no springs. Roscoe became so violently ill that he was forced to lie flat in the wagon bed with his head sticking out the back end, so that when the heaves hit him, he could vomit, or at least spit, without anyone losing time. An afternoon passed in that way, with Roscoe alternately vomiting and laying on his back in the wagon, trying to recover his equilibrium. When he lay on his back, the hot sun beat right down in his face, giving him a hard headache. The only way to block the sun was to put his hat over his face, but when he did that, the close atmosphere in the hat, which smelled like the hair lotion Pete Peters, the barber back in Fort Smith, had used liberally, made him sick to his stomach again. Soon Roscoe had nothing left in him to throw up but his guts, and he was expecting to see them come up at any time. When he finally sat up, feeling extremely weak, he found that they had come to the banks of a wide, shallow river. The soldiers had ignored his illness, but they couldn't ignore the river. "This is the Red," one soldier said. "That's Texas, right across yonder." Roscoe crawled out of his wagon, thinking to ride Memphis across, but found he couldn't make the climb into the saddle. Of course, Memphis was a tallish horse, but normally the saddle was reachable. Suddenly it wavered in the heat. It wasn't that the saddle was rising, it was that Roscoe's legs were sinking. He found himself sitting on the ground, holding to one stirrup. The soldiers laughed at his plight and pitched him on Memphis as if he were a sack of potatoes. "It's a good thing you run into us, deputy," one soldier said. "If you kept on going west into the territory, the darn Indians would have got you and et your testicles off." "Et my what?" Roscoe asked, appalled at the casual way the soldier dropped such a terrible remark. "I've heard that that occurs if you let them catch you alive," the soldier said. "Well, what's the Indian situation in Texas, then?" Roscoe asked. The soldiers seemed completely uninformed on the subject. They were from Missouri. All they knew about Indians was that they liked to do bad things to white captives. One mentioned that a soldier he knew had been shot with an arrow at such close range that the arrow went in one ear and the point came out the other side of the soldier's head. The soldiers seemed to enjoy telling such stories, but Roscoe couldn't share their enthusiasm. He lay awake most of the night, thinking about testicles and arrows in the head. The next afternoon, the soldiers turned west, assuring him that he only had to hold a course southwest, and he would eventually hit San Antonio. Though recovered from his drunk, he didn't feel very vigorous. Lack of proper sleeping conditions was slowly breaking down his health, it seemed. That evening, as dusk was falling, he was about to reconcile himself to another night spent propped up against a tree. He didn't like sleeping sitting up, but it meant he could be up and running quicker if the need arose. But before he could select a tree to lean against, he spotted a cabin a little distance ahead. When he approached, he saw an old man with a tobacco-stained beard sitting on a stump skinning a small animal, a possum, as it turned out. Roscoe felt encouraged. The old man was the first person he had seen in Texas, and perhaps would be a source of accurate information about the road. "Howdy," he said loudly. For the old man had not looked up from his skinning, and Roscoe considered it dangerous to take people by surprise. The old man didn't look up, but a form appeared in the doorway of the cabin. A girl, Roscoe thought, though in the dusk he couldn't be sure. "Mind if I stop for the night?" Roscoe asked, dismounting. The old man squinted at him briefly. "If you want supper, you'll have to skin your own varmint," he said. "Leave the gal alone. She's mine, bought and paid for." That struck Roscoe as strange. The old man's manner was anything but friendly. "Well, it's a little too late to go possum hunting," Roscoe said, trying to make light talk. "I've got a biscuit I can eat." "Leave the gal alone," the old man said again. The old man, a hard-looking customer, didn't look up again until he had finished skinning the possum. All Roscoe could do was stand around uneasily. The silence was heavy. Roscoe almost wished he had ridden on and spent the night sitting up against a tree. The level of civilization in Texas definitely wasn't very high if the old man was an example of it. "Come and get the varmint," the old man said to the girl. She slipped out and took the bloody carcass without a word. In the dusk, it was hard to make out much about her, except that she was thin. She was barefoot and had on a dress that looked like it was made from part of a cotton sack.
I gave 28 skunk hides for her, the old man said suddenly. You got any whiskey?
In fact, Roscoe did have a bottle that he had bought off the soldiers. He could already smell the frying meat, the possum, no doubt, and his appetite came back. He had nothing in his stomach and could think of little that he would rather eat than a nice piece of fried possum. Around Fort Smith, the Negroes kept the possums thinned out. They were seldom available on the tables of the white folks.
I got a bottle in my bag, Roscoe said. You're welcome to share it.
He assumed that such an offer would assure him a place at the table, but the assumption was wrong. The old man took the whiskey bottle when he offered it, and then sat right on the stump and drank nearly all of it. Then he got up without a word and disappeared into the dark cabin. He did not reappear. Roscoe sat on the stump, the only place there was to sit, and the darkness got deeper and deeper until he could barely see the cabin 15 feet away. Evidently the old man and the girl had no light, for the cabin was pitch dark. When it became plain that he was not going to be invited for supper, Roscoe ate the 2 biscuits he had saved. He felt badly treated, but there was little he could do about it. When he finished the biscuits, he pitched his bedroll up against the side of the cabin. As soon as he stretched out, the moon came up and lit the little clearing so brightly it made it hard to sleep. Then he heard the old man say, "Fix the pallet." The cabin was crudely built, with cracks between the logs big enough for a possum to crawl through, it seemed to Roscoe. He heard the old man stumbling around.
"God damn you, come here,"
the old man said. Roscoe began to feel unhappy that he had stopped at the cabin. Then he heard a whack, as if the old man had hit the girl with a belt or a razor strap or something. There was a scuffle which he couldn't help but hear, and the strap landed a couple of more times. The girl began to whimper.
"What's that?" Roscoe said,
thinking that if he spoke up, the old man might let be. But it didn't work. The scuffling continued, and the girl kept whimpering. Then it seemed they fell against the cabin, not a foot from Roscoe's head.
"If you don't lay still, I'll whoop you tomorrow until you wished you had," the old man said.
He sounded out of breath, and Roscoe tried to think of what July would do in such a situation. July had always cautioned him about interfering in family disputes, the most dangerous form of law work, July claimed. July had once tried to stop a woman who was going after her husband with a pitchfork and had been wounded in the leg as a result. In this case, Roscoe didn't know if it was even a family dispute that he was hearing. The old man had just said he bought the girl, though of course slavery had been over for years, and in any case the girl was white. The girl seemed to be putting up a good fight, despite her whimpering, for the old man was breathing hard and cursing her when he could get his breath. Roscoe wished more than ever that he had never spotted the cabin. The old man was a sorry customer, and the girl could only be having a miserable life with him. The old man soon got done with the girl, but she whimpered for a long time, an unconscious whimpering, such as a dog makes when it's having a bad dream. It disturbed Roscoe's mind. She seemed too young a girl to have gotten herself into such a rough situation, though he knew that in the hungry years after the war many poor people with large families had given children to practically anyone who would take them, once they got him an age to do useful work. Roscoe woke up soaked, though not from rain. He had rolled off his blanket in the night and been soaked by the heavy dew. As the sun rose, water sparkled on the grass blades near his eyes. In the cabin he could hear the old man snoring loudly. There was no sound from the girl. Since there was no likelihood that he would be offered breakfast, Roscoe mounted and rode off, feeling pretty sorry for the girl. The old man was a rascal who had not even thanked him for the whiskey. If the Texans were all going to be like him, it could only be a sorry trip. A mile or two along in the day, Memphis began to grow restive, flicking his ears and looking around. Roscoe looked, but saw nothing. The country was pretty heavily wooded. Roscoe thought maybe a wolf was following them, or possibly some wild pigs, but he could spot nothing. They covered 5 or 6 miles at a leisurely pace. Roscoe was half asleep in the saddle when a bad thing happened. Memphis brushed against a tree limb that had a wasp's nest on it, The nest broke loose from the limb and fell right in Roscoe's lap. It soon rolled off the saddle, but not before 20 or 30 wasps buzzed up. When Roscoe awoke, all he could see was wasps. He was stung twice on the neck, and twice on the face, and once on the hand as he was battling them. It was a rude awakening. He put Memphis into a lope and soon outran the wasps, but two had got down his shirt, and these stung him several more times before he could crush them to death against his body. He quickly got down from his horse and took off his shirt to make sure that no more wasps were in it. While he was standing there, smarting from yellow jacket stings, he saw the girl, the same skinny girl who had been in the cabin, wearing the same cotton sack dress. She tried to duck behind a bush, but Roscoe happened to look up just at the right second and see her. Roscoe hastily put his shirt back on, though the wasp stings were stinging like fire, and he would have liked to spit on them at least. But a man couldn't be rubbing spit on himself with a girl watching. "Well, come on out, since you're here," Roscoe said, thinking it interesting that the girl had easily kept up with Memphis for 6 miles. For all he knew, the old man had sent her to request more whiskey or something. The girl came slowly to him, shy as a rabbit. She was still barefoot, and her legs were scratched from all the rough country. She stopped 20 feet away, as if not sure how close she was supposed to come. She was rather a pretty girl, Roscoe thought, although her brown hair was dirty and she had bruises on her thin arms from the old man's rough treatment. "How come you to follow?" Roscoe asked. It was the first good look he had had at her. She seemed not more than 14 or 15. The girl just stood, too shy to talk. "I didn't get your name," Roscoe said, trying to be polite. "Ma called me her Janie," the girl said. "I run off from old Sam." "Oh," Roscoe said, wishing that the wasps had picked another time to sting him, and also that the girl named Janie had picked another time to run off. "I near killed him this morning," the girl said. "He used me bad, and I ain't really his anyway. It's just he give Bill some skunk pelts for me. I was going to take the axe and kill him, but then you come by and I run off with you." The girl had a low, husky voice, lower than a boy's, and once over her first moment of shyness, wasn't loath to talk. "I seen you get stung," she said. "There's a creek just along there. Mud poultices are the best for them yellow jacket stings. You mix them with spit and it helps." That, of course, was common knowledge, though it was thoughtful of the girl to mention it. The running away business, he thought, he'd better deal with at once. "Now, I'm a deputy sheriff," Roscoe said. "I'm headed down to Texas to find a man. I must travel fast, and I've got but one horse." He stopped, feeling sure the girl would take the hint. Instead, something like a smile crossed her face for an instant. "You call this traveling fast?" she asked. "I could have been 2 miles ahead of you just running on foot. I done already walked all the way here from San Antonio. I guess I can keep up with you unless you lope." The remark almost swayed Roscoe in the girl's favor. If she had been to San Antonio, she might know how to get back. He himself had been plagued from the start by a sense of hopelessness about finding his way, and would have welcomed a guide. But a runaway girl was not the sort of guide he had in mind. After all, the only reason he was looking for July was to report a runaway woman. How would it look if he showed up with another? July would think it highly irregular, and if the folks back in Fort Smith got wind of it, it could easily be made to look bad. After all, old Sam hadn't kept her around just because she could fry a possum in the dark. The memory of the frying possum crossed his mind, reminding him that he was very hungry. What with the wasp stings on top of the hunger, it was difficult to express himself clearly, or even to think clearly for that matter. As if reading his hunger from his expression, the girl quickly moved to strengthen her case. "I can catch varmints," she said. "Bill taught me the trick. Mostly I can outrun 'em. I can fish if you've got a hook. Oh, Roscoe said. I guess you caught that possum then, the girl shrugged. I can walk faster than possums can run, she said. If we get to that creek, I'll fix them stings. The stings were burning like fire, and Roscoe decided there would be no impropriety in letting the girl go as far as the creek. He considered offering to let her ride double, but before he could mention it, she ran on ahead. Not only could she walk faster than a possum could run, she could run faster than Memphis could walk. He had to put the horse into a trot to keep up with her. By the time they got to the creek, Roscoe felt light-headed from the combination of hunger and wasp stings. His vision was swimming again, as it had when he was drunk. A wasp had got him close to one eye. Soon the eye swelled shut. His head felt larger than it usually did. It was a very inconvenient life. And, as usual, when traveling got bad, he felt resentful of July for having married a woman who would run off. The girl beat him to the creek and began making mud poultices and spitting in them. She immediately dismantled a couple of crawdad houses to get the kind of mud she required. Fortunately, the creek had a high bank, which cast a little shade. Roscoe sat in the shade and allowed the girl to pack the mud poultices over the stings on his face. She even managed to get one on the swelling near his eye. "You get your shirt off," she said, startling Roscoe so that he obeyed. Mud felt cool. "Old Sam at Crawdad's," she said, as she sat back to survey her handiwork. "He can't shoot worth a darn, so he had to live off the varmints I could catch." "Well, I wish you could catch a fat rabbit," Roscoe said. "I'm plumb starved." The next moment, the girl was gone. She disappeared over the bank. Roscoe felt silly, for of course he had not really meant for her to go catch a rabbit. She might be fast, but rabbits were surely faster. His feelings of lightheadedness came back, and he lay down in the cool shade, thinking a little nap wouldn't hurt. He shut his eyes for a moment, and when he opened them, he saw a surprising sight, or two sights, really. One was a dead cottontail lying near him. The other was a girl who was wading down the edge of the creek with a short stick in her hands. Suddenly, a big bullfrog jumped off the bank. While the frog was in the air, the girl hit it with the stick and knocked it far up the bank. She scrambled up after it, and Roscoe stood up to watch, although he had only one eye to watch with. She had knocked the frog into some weeds, which slowed its hopping some. The frog cleared the weeds once, but it couldn't jump far, and the girl was soon on it with her stick. A moment later, she came down the bank holding the squashed frog by the legs. Its pink tongue was hanging out. "Got a rabbit and a frog," she said. "You want 'em fried up?" "I never et no frog," Roscoe said. "Who eats frogs?"
"You just eat the legs," the girl said. "Give me your knife."
Roscoe handed it over. The girl rapidly skinned the cottontail, which was indeed plump. Then she whacked the knife into the frog, threw the top half into the creek, and peeled the skin off the legs with her teeth. Roscoe had a few simple utensils in a saddlebag, which she got out without a word from him. Roscoe assumed the stings must be affecting him because he felt like he was in a dream. He wasn't asleep, but he felt no inclination to move. The top half of the frog, its dangling guts pale in the water, drifted over to shore. Two gray turtles surfaced and began to nibble at the guts. Roscoe mainly watched the turtles while a girl made a little fire and cooked the rabbit and the frog legs. To his surprise, the frog legs kept hopping out of the pan as if the frog was still alive. However, when she got them cooked, he ate one and was very pleased with the taste. Then he and the girl divided the rabbit and ate it to the last bite, throwing the bones into the creek. The combination of rabbit and frog innards had caused quite a congregation of turtles to collect.
"Niggers eat turtles," the girl said, cracking a rabbit bone between her teeth.
"They eat most anything," Roscoe said. "I guess they can't be choosy." After the meal, Roscoe felt less lightheaded. The girl sat a few feet away, staring into the waters of the creek. She seemed just a child. Her legs were muddy from wading in the creek, and her arms still bruised from her troubles with old Sam. Some of the bruises were blue, and others had faded to yellow. The cotton sack dress was torn in several places. The problem of what to do about her began to weigh on Roscoe's mind. It had been nice of her to feed him, but that didn't answer the question of what was to be done with her. Old Sam had not looked like a man who would take kindly to losing something he regarded as his property. He might be trailing them at that very moment, and since they weren't far from the cabin, he might be about to catch up.
"I guess that old man'll be coming after you," Roscoe said, feeling nervous.
"Nope," the girl said.
"Well, he said you was his," Roscoe said. "Why wouldn't he come after you?"
"He's got rheumatism in his knees," the girl said.
"Don't he have a horse?"
"No, it foundered," she said. "Besides, I took a big pan, whacked him across the knees to keep him still a few days."
"My goodness," Roscoe said. "You're a rough customer, I guess."
The girl shook her head. "I ain't rough," she said. "Old Sam was rough." She took the utensils to the creek and washed them before putting them back in the packs. Roscoe was painfully aware that he had to make a decision. It was nearly midday, and he had only covered a few miles. The girl was a handy person to have along on a trip, he had to admit. On the other hand, she was a runaway, and it would all be hard to explain to July.
"Don't you have no folks?" he asked,
hoping that there was a relative somewhere ahead whom he could leave the girl with. She shook her head. "They died," she said. "I had a brother, but the Indians run off with him. Ma died, and Pa went crazy and shot himself. I lived with the Dutchman till Bill got me."
"My Lord," Roscoe said. "Who was this Bill?"
A look of unhappiness crossed the girl's face. "Bill was taking me to Fort Worth," she said. "Then he run across old Sam up there by Waco, and they got drunk, and Sam traded for me." She never explained who Bill was, but Roscoe let it go. He decided to put off deciding what to do about her for at least a day. His wasp stings were paining him, and he didn't feel he could make a competent decision when he could only see out of one eye. Maybe they would hit a settlement, and he could find some nice family who needed help. They might take her off his hands. The only problem was the one horse. It didn't seem right for him to ride and her to walk. Of course, she weighed next to nothing. It wouldn't hurt Memphis to carry them both.
"You best come for a day or two," he said. "Maybe we can find you someplace better than where you were left. I'd hate for you to have to go back."
"I ain't going back," the girl said. "Old Sam had killed me." When Roscoe offered her a stirrup up, she looked at him strangely. "I don't mind the walk," she said.
"Well, we got to hurry," he said. "July's way ahead. Now jump up here."
The girl did, and Memphis looked annoyed, but he was too lazy to put up a fuss. The girl hooked her toes in the girth and held on to the saddle strings. "It's high, ain't it?" she said. "I can see over the bushes."
"You tell me if I go wrong," Roscoe said as they splashed across the creek. "I can't afford to miss that San Antone."
Chapter 44.
North of San Antonio, the country finally began to open up, to the relief of everyone. 2 weeks of mesquite had tried everyone's patience. Gradually, the mesquite thinned, and the country became less heavily wooded. The grass was better, and the cattle easier to handle. They grazed their way north so slowly most days that Newt felt it would take forever just to get out of Texas, much less make it to Montana. He still worked the drags. As the grass improved, the work was a little less dusty. He mainly rode along with the Rainy boys, discussing things that they might see up the trail. A major topic of speculation was whether the Indians had actually been wiped out or not. At night, around the campfire, there was always Indian stories being told, mostly by Mr. Gus. Once the crew had settled into the rhythm of night work, the captain took to doing what he always done. He removed himself from the company a little distance. Almost every night he would catch the hell bitch and ride away. It puzzled some of the men. "Reckon he don't like the way we smell," Bert Borum asked. "If that's what it is, I don't blame him," Jasper said. "P needs to wash his underwear more'n twice a year." "Well, Cap'n likes to go off," P said, ignoring the remark about his underwear. Augustus was in a card game with the Irishman and Lippy. The stakes were theoretical, since he had already won 6 months of their wages.
"Woodrow likes to be out there where he can sniff the wind," he said. "Makes him feel smart. Of course, he would be the first one massacred if there was any smart Indians left."
"I hope there ain't none," Lippy remarked.
"They wouldn't want you," Augustus said. "They don't bother with crazies."
"I wish we'd get a cook," Jasper said. "I'm darn tired of eating slop." It was a common complaint. Since Bolivar's departure, the food had been uneven. Various men trying their hands at cooking. Call had ridden into several settlements, hoping to find someone they could hire as cook, but he had had no luck. Augustus usually cooked breakfast, catering to his own interest entirely and drawing many complaints because he favored scrambling eggs, a style several hands, Dish Boget in particular, found revolting. "I like my eggs with just a light fry," Dish said, morning after morning, only to watch helplessly as Augustus turned them into batter and poured them into a big skillet.
"Don't do that, Gus," he said. "You'll get the white and the yellow all mixed up."
"They're going to get mixed up in your stomach anyway," Augustus pointed out. Dish was not the only one who hated scrambled eggs.
"I don't eat the white of eggs, if I can help it," Jasper said. "I hear it causes blindness."
"Where'd you hear nonsense like that?" Augustus asked,
but Jasper couldn't remember. However, by breakfast time, everyone was usually so hungry they ate whatever they could get, complaining with every bite.
"This coffee had float a stove lid," Call said one morning. He always rode in time for breakfast.
"I generally eat mine with a spoon," Lippy said. "This is a free country we live in," Augustus reminded them. "Anyone who don't like this coffee can spit it out and make their own."
No one cared to do anything that extreme. Since Call didn't believe in stopping for a meal at noon, breakfast was a necessity, whoever cooked.
"We got to get a cook, even if it's a bad one," Augustus said. "It's too dangerous for a valuable man like me. I might get shot over eggs."
"Well, Austin ain't far," Call said. "We can try there."
The day was fine and the herd moving nicely, with Dish holding the point as if he had held it all his life. Austin was only 20 miles to the east. Call was ready to go, but Augustus insisted on changing his shirt.
"I might meet a lady," he said. "You can look for the cook."
They rode east and soon picked up a wagon trail into Austin. But they had not followed it far when Augustus suddenly swung his horse to the north.
"That ain't the way to Austin," Call said.
"I just remembered something," Augustus said.
He loped off without another word. Call turned the hell bitch and followed. He thought perhaps Gus was thirsty. They weren't far from a little creek that fed into the Guadalupe. Sure enough, it was a little spring-fed creek that Augustus had been looking for. It ran through a small grove of live oaks spread along the slope of a good-sized hill. Gus and old Malaria stopped on the hill, looking down at the creek, a little pool that formed below the trees. Gus was just sitting and looking, which was odd. But then Gus was odd. Call rode up, wondering what had drawn Gus's attention to the spot, and was shocked to see that Gus had tears in his eyes. They wet his cheeks and glistened on the ends of his mustache. Call didn't know what to say because he had no idea what was wrong. Gus sometimes laughed until he cried, but
He seldom just cried. Moreover, it was a fine day. It was puzzling, but he decided not to ask. Gus sat for 5 minutes, not saying a word. Carl got down and relieved himself to pass the time. He heard Gus sigh and looked up to see him wiping his eyes with a bandana. "What has come over you?" Carl asked finally. Augustus took off his hat for a moment and let his head cool.
"Woodrow, I doubt that you would understand," he said, looking at the grove and the pool.
"Well, if I don't, I don't," Carl said. "I sure don't so far."
"I call this Clara's Orchard," Augustus said. "Me and her discovered it one day while on a buggy ride. We come out here on picnics many a time."
"Oh," Carl said. "I might have known it would have something to do with her. I doubt there's another human being over whom you'd shed a tear." Augustus wiped his eyes with his fingers.
"Well, Clara was lovely," he said. "I expect it was the major mistake of my life, letting her slip by. Only you don't understand that because you don't appreciate women.
If she didn't want to marry you, I don't guess there was much you could have done about it," Carl said, feeling awkward. The subject of marriage was not one he was comfortable with.
"It weren't that simple," Augustus said, looking at the creek and the little grove of trees and remembering all the happiness he had had there.
He turned old Malaria and they rode on toward Austin, though the memory of Clara was as fresh in his mind as if it were her, not Woodrow Call, who rode beside him. She had had her vanities, mainly clothes. He used to tease her by saying that he had never seen her in the same dress twice, but Clara just laughed. When his second wife died and he was free to propose, he did one day on a picnic to the place they called her orchard. She refused instantly, without losing a trace of her merriment. "Why not?" he asked. "I'm used to my own ways," she said. "You might try to make me do things I wouldn't want to do." "Don't I indulge your every whim?" he asked. "Yes, but that's because you haven't gotten me," Clara said. "I bet you'd change fast if I ever let you get the upper hand." But she had never let him get the upper hand, though it seemed to him that she had surrendered it without a fight to a dumb horse trader from Kentucky. Carl was a little embarrassed for Augustus.
"When was you the happiest, Carl?" Augustus asked.
"Happiest about what?" Carl asked.
"Just about being a live human being, free on the earth," Augustus said.
"Well, it's hard to single out any one particular time," Carl said.
"It ain't for me. I was the happiest right back there by that little creek. I fell short of the mark and lost the woman. But the times were sweet."
It seemed an odd choice to call. After all, Gus had been married twice. "What about your wives?" he asked.
"Well, it's peculiar," Augustus said. "I was never drawn to fat women, and yet I married two of them. People do odd things, all except you. I don't think you ever wanted to be happy anyway. It don't suit you, so you managed to avoid it."
"That's silly," Carl said.
"It ain't either," Augustus said. "I don't guess I've watched you punish yourself for 30 years to be totally wrong about you. I don't know what you've done to deserve the punishment."
"You got a strange way of thinking," Carl said. They had hardly ridden 3 miles from the grove when they spotted a little camp at the foot of the limestone bluff. It was near a pool and a few trees.
"I'll bet that's Jake," Carl said. "No, it's just Laurie," Augustus said. "She's resting by a tree, and I bet Jake's gone to town and left her."
Carl looked again, but the camp was half a mile away, and all he could see was the horses and the pack mule. Throughout his years as a ranger, Augustus had always been renowned for his remarkable eyesight. Time and again, on the high plains and in the Pecos country, it had been proven that he could see farther than other people. In the shimmering mirages, the men were always mistaking sage bushes for Indians.
Call himself could shade his eyes and squint and still not be certain, but Augustus would merely glance at the supposed Indian for a moment, laugh, and go back to card playing or whiskey drinking or whatever he might be doing.
"Yep, that's a big tribe of sage bushes," he would say.